Hello, reader. You're plugged in to another episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. We hope you enjoy it.
Hi, I'm Rory Shabalala. I have many roles in the world, but perhaps the most important one is that, and for this purpose, is that I am the husband to an amazing woman, Nozipho Shabalala, who has blessed us recently with her first gift of authorship to the world. And so I have the privilege and obligation to interview her today and for us to just have a conversation and let you all in, actually, potentially, on some of the things that might not be as obvious in the book itself. So it gives me absolute pleasure, great pleasure, and absolute joy to be having this conversation with you. Noz, hello.
Hi, love.
Hey, yeah, we have to, on a podcast, we have to pretend like we just met you, but
hi, Rory.
Of course,
thank
I work
so
up
much
next
for
to you.
So
we're talking about your book, After the Fires, your first foray into kind of authorship of your own books. Of course, you have contributed in various other publications before. You know what, I'm before we even get very far in the conversation, what I'm really curious about is, tell us what it has felt like to become an author. Because you don't just pick up the pen and just start writing. Just take us into the journey of putting something like this together.
You know, as you know, this wasn't something on my radar, right? This wasn't something that I intended to do. So I almost feel like, I wouldn't say it crept up on me, but I think it was, you know, as we often talk about sometimes moments, like a question that's sort of lingering at the back of your mind and you're not aware that it's waiting for you to answer. And I think this was like a sometimes moment for me in that sense that I didn't set out to be an author. So I wasn't prepared mentally to what that identity would look like or feel like. I didn't have an opportunity to try it on, if that makes sense, or to envision what that might feel like. And in a way, I think that's been a blessing in a way to come into it in the way that it happened, where I didn't think I was going to write a book. I didn't intend to write a book. And then through a series of events, I end up putting down my story. And I suppose on the one level, it's given me just a deep respect for people who do this for a living, because I don't know how you keep going into that very deep, reflective and introspective space to be able to write. And it's also taught me a lot. I've learned so much about the publishing machinery and how that works and how stories actually journey from the mind of the author to the world, and a lot of the machinery of what that process looks like. And then there's the final layer of how it's received by the world. And I would imagine every author sets out to write something that will be well received and will resonate with a specific audience. And I'm kind of not very clear on my own, you know, how well defined that audience is, because I'm surprised at some of the places where it's reaching. And I'm also affirmed by some of the places where I had expected it to reach.
Yeah. Yeah. So this wasn't the story that you were meant to write. This was, as you've said in various other interviews, this was a story that was inside of you.
Yeah.
You know, someone's just joined and watched and doesn't even know what the story is about. Maybe just tell us a little bit about After the Fires, the story, or at least a summary of what it's about, but more importantly, I think, and more curiously, why it overtook the story that you were supposed to actually write.
Yeah, it's a brilliant question. So if I go back to the story that I was supposed to write, candid conversation with the publisher pitches me and says, we think you should write a story. And I'm like, I don't think so, but about what? And they say, well, we think you, if we look at all of the global stages that you've been on, the really famous people that you've spoken to in conversation, the Bill Gates of this world, the presidents of this world, Melinda Gates, you name it, the list is endless. We think that there's a book about what you've taken away from all of those conversations. And it sounded convincing. And I set out to write the book. And as you know, I tried and nothing came. And I tried and nothing came. And I remember in a panic calling the publisher and saying, I don't think I'm cut out for this. I don't think I can actually write. Nothing's coming. And then we arrive at the sort of a negotiated space to say, well, because we want to anchor your story before we bring in the story of everybody else, why don't we start with your story? And that came a lot more easily. And 3 chapters in and having to submit the first 3 chapters, it was a very quick conversation and a convergence of minds to say, actually, we don't think there's space for other people's stories around this, and that this was the story that I needed to continue with and actually give it more space and expand it instead of minimize it. And so the line that I keep talking about is, you know, arriving at a place and realizing that this was an invitation not to write the story that was expected of me, but to write the story that was within me. And I think it overtook the story that was expected of me because of how close to the marrow this book becomes. Mm. The story that was expected of me, I think, is a continuation of me as I am understood in the world, as a conduit for the conversations that other people need to have with the world, as a channel and as a platform, and very much about exercising the discipline of minimizing my voice, my story, so that I can be a clear channel and I can be a clear platform. This is a markedly different story in the sense that I actually step out of those shadows and step fully into the light with my own story. And I think it's unexpected because up until this moment, I don't think I've been this open and vulnerable with anybody the world, except you.
Yeah. So this is an interesting potential analog or metaphor for life, this idea that we either get to write the stories that are expected of us or the stories that are inside of us. And I guess for you, especially as a public figure, the pressure to write the story that's expected of you in life in general is very strong relative to the story that's inside of you. You know, so tell us a little bit about that, because you write in some parts about it, but you don't really go into it as far as the book is concerned. But just tell us about life in general as being the story that's expected of you versus the story that's inside of you, especially when you've come out of poverty, when you are the one that's the first in family in many ways. And so the weight of expectation then gets put of you in that way. And then, of course, in the various other spaces that you're in, spaces of, you know, intense expectation versus accommodation of what's inside of you. Talk to us about that.
I actually really think that as social beings, we love a story that has a hero or heroine in it, as a breakthrough story, a winning story. We are able to consume stories of struggle and suffering with the promise that in the final chapter, it all comes together and it's a great story. I don't think we're really good at just sharing messy stories. I mean, I don't read a lot of messy stories that just end in messiness. Mm. There's always the crescendo, you know, whether it's the framework of the hero's journey or whatever the framework is, we kind of have this expectation that that's where it ends. And I personally always, even outside of this book, feel that when people do come and invite me to speak and to share aspects of my story, it is that linearity that they're looking for, that linear, this is where I started from poverty and this is where I am. But what I try to do in the book is actually showcase the complexity of some of the personal provocations and reckonings that happen in life, and that sometimes these are cyclical. Sometimes you have to revisit old things that you thought you had broken through, only to realize maybe you've broken through the surface, but you haven't completely freed yourself from it. And so as I talk about the book, which in essence is using my personal story as a frame, but the central theme being about learning how to recognize when control has served me well and when it's become a disservice. And it's about understanding that tightrope, how something that we grew up with as a crutch can be a light in our lives, but in certain instances and contexts, it can be a shadow. And so the book tries to break that linearity and that beauty of the storytelling that we expect, and to say, actually, this is a cyclical journey that I've been on. There have been breakthroughs, but there have been setbacks as well. I've progressed, but I've regressed. I struggle with control in different ways. And there isn't this beautiful place in the book where I end and I go, ta-da! Mm. You know, the last chapter is probably the hardest chapter. Mm-hmm. And I've been deliberate about writing that chapter in that way because, as I've shared with you many times before, I also think that the best conversations are not the ones that end in a perfect full stop. The best conversations are the ones that lead to new questions and open up new canvases of curiosity. And so this is why I wanted to break that expectation in the book as well.
Aren't you, in the way you're answering, kind of playing into that very thing? You're giving us the answers that we expect from a Nosy Paul, the refined, polished, profound, and not just like messy and what's inside of you about, well, the expectations that life and that get put on you across the different facets of life and that have been put on you across the different facets of life versus what's been inside of you, your need to become a breadwinner when maybe all you wanted was to buy the Levi's jeans and the All-Stars that you speak about in the story, your need to be polished and put together when all you really wanted was to have dreadlocks and the expectations. So there's what you see across this book is this also, you know, apart from control and no control, you're also seeing, you know, the obligation to live into what is expected of you versus the authenticity to live out what's inside of you. Do you want to try again in a way that's less polished? Yes, please.
So let's take that invitation again. So I stand by my first answer because I think it's an important frame. But if we were to go deeper, I think the tension between what is expected of you and what you want to do, simplistically, is a constant everyday tension. I think in every one of our identities, that's true. And then I'll give some personal examples to land them for you. But I think, you know, if you are in a leadership role right now, there's an expectation of what leadership behavior looks like. I mean, we even go as far as, you know, calling out and labeling certain leadership behaviors in a corporate context and saying, this is how leaders behave and so on. Whereas, you know, that might not be the thing that you feel like doing in that moment. In a relationship, in a marriage, right? There might be a thing like, hey, as the wife right now, this is what you're expected to do. You're supposed to go on a 4-hour drive with your husband to Limpopo when you don't feel like going. And why are you laughing?
No, you're throwing shade. You're throwing shade.
But it's an expectation that as a wife, you're going to show up with them and do that. And so I don't think it's a singular moment. I think it's a constant tension that we have to navigate. And you and I always talk about how life and relationships are negotiated spaces. You don't get to go through life just only doing the things that you want to do and just being the person that you want to be. Sometimes there's a little bit of give and take as to what do I need to do right now, even if it might not be the thing I want to do forever.
Oh, you're not doing it again. You're pontificating and hypothesizing. Tell
Maybe
us, we're asking you. We're
no,
asking you.
Give,
tell
I,
us.
I said I'm
give us
land,
some examples.
I want to land at some. Let me go to university, right? Let me go to me on the restaurant floor.
Yes.
In Hatfield. Mm. I'm in my first year. I'm looking around me. All my friends are having the best time of their lives. You know, first year, university. Mm. And I am on the restaurant floor every Friday, every Saturday morning, every Saturday afternoon, and every Sunday morning. Because if I don't, then I don't have something to eat. I don't have bus fare. I never could afford textbooks in any event, so I used to photocopy other people's textbooks, but I still had to pay.
In the way you hope no one photocopies your book.
Please don't photocopy my book. And then I had to pay for those copies in any event. that for me was a very real tension about what do I really want to do right now versus what do I have to do? Mm. And I think the thing that allowed me to do what I needed to do was knowing that it wasn't permanent. It wasn't forever. I knew that if I just kept at it for as long as I needed to, I would be able to get through it.
How did you know that?
Because, and I think it's a great question, like how do, like where
I
does
hope
that
all
belief?
My questions are great, by the way.
Well, how did we choose this guy? Like, so I was raised in a family where without it necessarily having to be spoken at, or put up on a plaque in the house, that anything that is dependent on how I show up and the effort that I put in is within my control. So I knew that I was smart enough to get through the content if I applied myself and if I studied and if I did my assignments in advance. I knew that being on the restaurant floor was painful if you're doing, you know, a night shift on Friday, then a double shift on Saturday and a morning shift on Sunday. But if it's the physical pain that I need to work through, I can work through that. I can work through standing for hours. It's not going to break me. It's not going to be nice. I'm not going to enjoy it. But it's actually dependent on me. So for contexts where the buck ends with me, I'm pretty confident that I can get through that. There are moments when I'm not in control of the environment or what happens to me. And those are even harder moments, right? But where it relies on me and me getting through something, that's up to me.
Except in the final chapter, which you've alluded to,
yes,
where that doesn't seem to hold up.
Yeah.
So what do you say to the nosy poor in your final chapter? And what do you say to someone else who might find that conviction jarring, because they're saying, but I'm working hard, I'm doing all those things and sacrificing, and yet it's not turning out the way that I was hoping that it would. Why is it true for you and not for me, says the unemployed graduate, says the nosy poor in your final chapter. What would you have to say to that?
So let me start with the person who's in the fire right now and saying, I don't see life after the fire. It's like I'm in the fire. I didn't know in the moments when I was in, like, in the fire, that all of these things would be working out for my good. Like, if I'm standing now with the gift of hindsight, I can look back and say, I see how this has enabled me to do this and has led me down to do this. The only thing that I knew in that moment is that this is the only shot I have. So even if it is an unpleasant experience, this is the only pathway I have. I don't have another option. If I'm not on the restaurant floor, then I have to go home. And so it's a lot harder to be on the restaurant floor and doubt that this is going to get me through. I have to believe.
Mm.
I have to hope that it's actually more of a hope and faith that it's going to work out. I would be lying if I'm saying that as I stood there, I knew that exactly that I'd be here today. I didn't. I just was like, if I bring my full self and I bring my effort and I bring my energy, it's got to work out.
Mm.
It's hope, it's faith, and those things.
And I guess it's also about amplifying the chances that it might happen, and you being at home
just reduces
the chances,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know, you know, these quirky sayings, right? Like, you know, something like luck finds those who are prepared for it, that kind of thing. Like, I have to be in the arena to take the shot.
Mm.
You know, I have to have the ball in my hand to take the shot.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'm not any closer to it. And then to Nozipo in the final chapter, I think that for me has probably been the biggest reminder that I'm not through with this need to be in control yet. Because after all that I've gone through and all that I talk about in the book, I still show up in that IVF journey with the hope and belief that if I do this and this and this and this and this, it will work out. And then it doesn't. And then it doesn't. And again and again and again. And so it's a reminder that this is not a once-off linear journey. It will keep visiting me in different ways. The lesson for me is seeing it in that moment and trying the best that I can to relinquish control.
So we don't have a lot of time left, believe it or not. And there's so much that we could speak about. I think the thing that you don't write about, which is the funny thing about our lives, is that they were happening in parallel to one another, even though we didn't know each other.
Yeah.
So we were both at Varsity at the same time, in the same place.
I was in the library, he was definitely not in the library.
As well. We were just not on the same floor. Mm. I was going into and around the restaurant that you used to work at. Mm. I find that to be quite an interesting part of the story of our lives, in that we walked past each other potentially so many times and didn't realize that we were walking past our soulmates, and yet we were having very different experiences of life in our early 20s, late teens and early 20s. I came relatively to you. I came from relative privilege relative to your experience. I was staying at home with my parents. You were staying in a one-room flat sharing with a host of other girls. You were having sugar melted on bread.
In a snack witch maker.
I was going home to a home-cooked meal. Humble at times, but it was still much better compared to what you were having. What is it that you then, because of course you then write about it, but and please don't make me blush.
Oh, but my goodness.
How do those parallel paths lead to a oneness, which you write about in how do people with such different backstories end up pursuing a single future story?
Sure. I'm not going to say it's a great question. But I actually think that despite our differences in how we were raised, I think there's a lot of commonality and alignment that has brought us together and keeps us together. One of the things I often get accused of, and I've heard you being accused of this as well, is that I married myself. And that, I think, is because of a shared ambition. So wanting to have a fingerprint in the world, wanting to do important work in the world. I think a shared drive and energy. We're both workaholics, whether you look at me funny or whatever.
Work-life balance is my mantra. I don't know what you're talking about.
We're both workaholics, work really, really hard. And I think that we're also both bridges in different ways, where we straddle multiple worlds and we become a bridge for the worlds we come from and bridge that to the worlds we're trying to create and trying to connect different people. I think that's part of the glue of our oneness that brings us together. And I think there's also just the thing around language. I mean, I'm going to try and explain this, and I might not do a good job about it, but I think there's a way in which we're able to expand our canvas of language that allows us to connect in a lot of different ways, that we can have a book, we can have a conversation about a book that you insisted that you didn't want to read before it went to print, and it be a genuine conversation of discovery between the two of us in new ways. So you can blush now, but that's the answer.
Of course, that's just in, you know, the marriage setting, but all across the book, you present us with stories of partnership. Mm. In various ways, partnerships with people older than you, partnerships with your peers, partnerships with people younger than you, whether it's the former deputy president who becomes an important character, whether it's a partnership as well between your mom and dad, whether it is the partnerships that you subsequently go on to have with peers and so on. So can you maybe give us a sense, because I guess none of us who you have cited in this book knew that we were auditioning for roles in a book. We were just living.
Yeah.
What do you think it takes to have the type of impact in a person's life that leads you to be named in the book as part of the inflection point, whether you are the former deputy president, Mamlambo Nguka, or whether you're your former boss at a corporate who, you know, put the absolute fear and pain in your life?
And this is going to be an academic answer. Please just bear with me. Let me explain it. In the book, I talk about, there's a chapter called Return on Luck. And the chapter really is about this idea that we don't always, it's a concept, of course, borrowed from Jim Collins. So let me start there. But it's this idea that we don't always control the circumstances we find ourselves in, but how we respond in those circumstances determines whether we realize a return on luck or not. I then take that same concept and I extend it to Hulak, and Jim Collins does the same. And he says, there's certain people that you come across in life who might be good luck people or bad luck people, but they have such an impact that your encounter with them allows you to realize a return on luck. And I couldn't find a better frame to explain that, because there are people who were destiny defining. You've spoken about Mam, who I dedicate an entire chapter to. But there are also people along my journey who gave me the blueprint for what I don't want to be and the behaviors I don't want to replicate. And that is just as important in helping me shape who I want to be. Not knowing what I don't want to be has just been as important. And I'm going to close it off by saying this. There's an exercise that that a lot of facilitators use called the river of life. And this idea that you draw a river, and then along the river, you would have rapids, you could have a waterfall, you can have a little pond, and then you go and you put people around that river and what they've represented in your life. I actually drew a river of life as part of my writing process. I sat down and I drew my river, and I was like, oh, that was a definite waterfall, not a good moment. And there were people's names around that. And then there were definite moments of pause and stillness and reflection. Those were my ponds. There were moments where I was under a bridge and flourishing and, you know, that kind of thing. So I think we meet people who help us define who we want to be, and we meet people who help us define what we don't want to be. And then we also meet people who, when we're not sure of what we want to be or don't want to be, stand in the gap for us and almost hold the space for us to leap forward into what we need to be.
One of the characters in the book who really comes towards the end of the book is a gentleman called Telo Lerenswa Phakathe Shabalala, who is a miracle baby that you and I eventually get to have. When you've had a life as like the life you've portrayed and certainly described in this book, how do you navigate the temptations of trying to make sure that his life is not a meandering river, and rather carved out channel towards, defined outcomes? And how does that play out in your life?
I think it's a very difficult thing, because I think the natural reaction or posture is to try and cover, overprotect, minimize the chances that your child has similar experiences, especially the undesirable experiences. But I just think that I feel that Dilo is also teaching me a different way of relinquishing control. Right now, as you would know, we are in the middle of potty training. If you remember, we actually tried a couple of, just before this time now, a couple of months ago, I think towards earlier on in the year, and it just went nowhere. He was just not having it. And when I was reflecting on what was going on and also speaking to other moms, they were like, he'll let you know when he's ready. And the lesson for me was, I actually realized I need to allow myself to be led more, and especially by the people who I think are most unlikely to lead me, and to submit myself to being led by a 2-year-old. so that we potty train when he's ready. And now, as we're doing it now, you can almost see the difference because he's in the driving seat and he's leading and he's ready. And he finds it exciting to make his announcement that, you know, I peed in the potty today. The lesson has not been lost on me that it's a lot easier when I don't force and I don't hold the reins tightly and just allow myself to be led. I can't promise that my son is going to lead me in everything as of his life's journey. I can probably promise there'll be moments where I'm going to have the reins in my hands instead of his. But then I've got you to help me balance it out. Mm-hmm. But I think I'm doing a decent job in this little phase of allowing myself to be led.
Please tell us, we're fast running out of time, but just please tell us the part of your life as narrated in this book that you find most difficult to believe. You know, there are moments in this book where you write things that if I didn't know us,
you were like,
I'd be like, keepers, you're stretching to make this a fairy tale story. You know, when your mom is lying in that hospital bed and she beckons to the two of us and she can't speak and she holds our hands.
Yeah.
And how that ends is in the book for someone to read. But, you know, I look at, if I was reading, I'd be like, you know, these guys are just, are there other moments where you look at it and you say, this is just too good to be true?
The penis enlargement moment is just too good to be true.
Right.
Right. So no, Rory did not go for penis enlargement, but I was.
which became too good to be true.
I was walking down the street. Church, do you want me to tell the story?
No, let them read it.
There's a penis enlargement moment, which is just completely. There's a moment when I'm in Davos walking at night on my own and just crying it out. That just happened. Like, it was one of those things that happened and I'm like, I can't believe this is what's actually happening.
Yeah.
So there are a couple of things where, you know, when you rocked up in Rwanda and I'm like, no ways, not this guy. So yeah, read the book. But there are so many moments that, I had to keep reminding myself that whatever might sound far-fetched to some people is okay. Mm. It's my story. Mm. And those who know me will validate those parts of the story. The opening chapter, when I talk about the moment, we've heard a number in some of the launches, people saying, yes, I was there.
Mm.
Because it actually happened like that. And I think it brings us back to why there are so many of these moments that I just started to think that this is how one goes through life. So you just have lots of toughness, lots of suffering, and then every now and then there's a magical moment. And you kind of had to ground me back and say, no, this is pretty extraordinary, and maybe there is something in the request for you to write a book.
And it was true for you. And you spend a lot of time as well in the book attributing it to God and your relationship with God. God is in vogue at the moment, and he's claimed by the worst and the best of humanity at the moment. How does one read the way you attribute this to God as being, you know, outside of just the in vogue God that we hear about, and, you know, to speak to us about the spiritual relationship that you have and its significance?
Yeah, when I was reflecting on my consistent referencing back to God, I also wanted to show that it wasn't this fairy tale relationship. There were moments where I was just like in deep frustration to say, like, after all these promises you make in the Bible, where are you? Why have you left me here? Why are you allowing this to happen to me? And so the relationship in itself is one that's hard and difficult and tense, and I stray and I come back, and I stray and I come back, and I try to get into control, and eventually start arriving at a place where I'm starting to believe maybe there is a scaffolding around me. Maybe there is a safety net that has actually never gone away. Because when I look at, oh, in hindsight, this is how things were working themselves out, I'm like, okay, maybe the promise that all things work for my good actually is true. But in the midst of it, I was mad. I was angry at God, like at many times in my journey. Even in the last chapter, I was just like, "Ah, dude, come on."
Yeah.
You know. So again, that relationship and the complexity and the tension and the anger in it, I think, is also a proxy for the bigger story of who really is in control.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. So let's wrap, Noz.
You've been threatening to wrap.
I'm curious. We really do have to wrap this now. But take us then. You've gone on this journey where you've become an author. You've written a book. We get to see the Instagram posts. We get to read the book. Take us into the life of an author over the past year. What are some of the pivotal moments? You said you in the beginning that you were stuck. What does being stuck look like? You know, do you just sit and just start writing? Just give us a picture of what it has looked like for you, because this is where your river has gotten you thus far. And then tell us what is this for, and where does it lead to next?
So writing is a lonely process, or that's how I experienced it. Once you've signed the contract, you're given space to actually now do the work. And I think we sometimes have this misconception that we're surrounded by people giving input. Actually, that's not the case at all. I found it to be a very lonely process. And in hindsight, realize the loneliness was necessary. The quiet was necessary for me to actually go and sort of dredge up the things that needed dredging up. There's a lot of conversations with self that you have. For me, one of the things were like, what is my story to tell versus what's not my story to tell? There's certain things that happened to me, but I wasn't the central character. It's not my story. And so do I withhold that? Do I filter that out? So this constant negotiation of the legitimacy of what you're going to share, and whether you're the most credible person to be talking about that. I also in the book try to not educate, but try to weave in the tapestry of the country and where the country's at to bring some context to what's happening in the moment. That's very scary because you can't get that wrong. You can't write something that is factually incorrect based on how you experienced it. There's certain things. So there's a deep research piece that I actually had to sit in as well, which I didn't expect. But I realized, did this happen on this date? When exactly was Nelson Mandela standing on the steps at the Union Buildings? What was that exact date? You know, so
and
there's...
I guess in this world also... politically incorrect. So you have to worry about factual correctness and political.
And then whether it's politically correct or incorrect. I'm even talking about my gay friend, my gay best friend, you know, how's that landing when I'm talking about God at the same time? And if I'm comfortable with that duality, what does somebody else feel who's reading it? And having to make the call to say, that's my life. And how you consume it is that. The last part of the experience, now that it's all written, you're always accusing me of being a public figure / celebrity. And I'm always like, no, I'm not. But this is probably the first time where I'm like, okay, Noz, if there's a billboard, maybe you got to give a little bit of an inch. So that part of my life is like now a little interesting, to be seen a lot more than I had allowed myself to be seen before. And in being seen, to be owned by people a lot more, because people feel that they have access to your story, and therefore they own and have access and should have access to you. And then just practice your fingers, because the signing is real.
Yeah, and I guess that's why we're so afraid of loneliness, because we're afraid of who we might discover in that. And quite often, if we do it well, it's ourselves. And if we're generous, then we get to put it in words and share it with the world. So thank you for this amazing time and for this amazing gift to the world. And may it go on to become bestseller across jurisdictions.
Thank you so much. We are so excited. And thank you to everybody who's bought a copy. Thank you to everybody reading and listening to this conversation as well. And thank you, my love, for a beautiful conversation.
Thank you for listening to this episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. Did you love what you heard? Don't just stop at the stories. Buy the books. Visit your favorite bookstore to grab your next read. And remember to subscribe, share, and join us again next week for more fascinating conversations. Until then, happy reading.